Good morning, Council. This is an first argument for the Southern panel today. The case is 81596. Mr. Jimerson, forgive me, but how do you pronounce your client's name? Or excuse me, Mr. Eisenberg?
Devin Parshad.
Devin Parshad, okay. And Landis is the appropriate pronunciation, Mr. Jimerson?
Yes, Justice Hardison, and good morning to you, sir.
All right, thank you. So, Justice Stiglich is not able to be physically present during argument today, but of course is participating in this case. I am sitting in for Justice Perry-Gary, who has recused. So we'll get started. Mr. Eisenberg, if you're ready to proceed on behalf of petitioners.
Yes, I am, Your Honor. And I tried to alert the clerk that I wanted to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. I hope that message got through.
If not, that's fine.
Thank you. And may it please the court, I'm Robert Eisenberg, appearing for the petitioners. Before I get to the two primary issues in this case, I do need to clarify one thing. In the plaintiff's answer to our writ petition, they repeatedly say that we're trying to set aside the mistrial, and that just is false. When Judge Baer announced his intent to grant the mistrial, defense lawyers pleaded with him not to discharge the jury until they had the opportunity to go to this court and seek emergency review. Judge Baer refused, and he discharged the jury when he granted the mistrial. Once he did that, the mistrial could not be undone. The jury could not be called back to continue the trial. So we cannot, and we are not, asking this court to set aside the actual mistrial, which is what the plaintiffs say we're asking. What we're asking this court to do is to set aside Judge Baer's subsequent written order and to set aside Judge Early's order granting about $120,000 in sanctions. Now, I'd like to talk about this sanctions issue first because I filed a notice with the court informing the court that there was a fairly recent defense verdict on the second trial of this case. In light of that, we believe that if this court reverses the sanction issue by finding that the defendants did not purposely cause a mistrial, and the first issue about Judge Baer's order is essentially moot and the court doesn't need to decide it. So I'm going to address the cost issue first. We contend that the statute is crystal clear and does not need any interpretation. The statute allows a judge to award costs and attorney's fees against a party who purposely caused a mistrial. And we contend that that means just what it says, that the party must have done the act with the purpose of causing a mistrial. And we ask the court not to remove the word purposely from the statute. The legislature could have said that sanctions can be awarded against a party who caused a mistrial or who mistakenly caused a mistrial or who negligently caused a mistrial. They didn't do that. Sanctions can be awarded against a party who purposely caused a mistrial. And that's a very high standard. That situation would arise, for example, if a trial is going horribly and a lawyer recognizes it and the lawyer needs to end that trial and try to get essentially a mulligan and get a new trial. And so the lawyer does something to intentionally cause a mistrial and get a second trial. And that's where the sanction statute comes in. Now, neither side in this case was able to find a case law. Other states except one case in the whole United States, and that's the Cleston case from South Dakota. And they have a statute that was very similar to Nevada's. It allows sanctions if a party intentionally causes a mistrial. And intentionally, we contend, is a synonym for purposely. And in that case, a lawyer recklessly violated a motion and an order in limine by not adequately editing a video deposition, and it resulted in them. And the court in that case said, even recklessly causing a mistrial is not the same as intentionally or causing a mistrial intentionally. And the court said sanctions would not be allowed. And so we think that same concept should apply here. The party or the lawyer must do something for the purpose of causing a mistrial under our statute. Nobody has ever suggested here that defense counsel wanted a mistrial and that they used the exhibit that had already been admitted into evidence, that they used it for the purpose of causing a mistrial. And even the plaintiffs here have never suggested that the defense used it for the purpose of causing a mistrial. As I mentioned earlier, defense counsel pleaded with Judge Baer not to grant the mistrial. And Judge Baer himself repeatedly said that it was a mistake by the defense attorneys and they didn't realize the impact of what would happen. Even Judge Early, when she granted the costs under NRS 18.070, she said, I would not find that you intentionally wanted a mistrial. Of course you wouldn't want a mistrial. They didn't want a mistrial, and you didn't want a mistrial. And the you she's referring to is defense counsel. There's not a whisper of evidence in this case that the defense attorneys used the exhibit that had already been stipulated into evidence for the purpose of causing a mistrial, and therefore they did not purposely cause a mistrial under the statute.
Mr. Eisenberg, if I could interrupt your argument a moment. With respect to the interpretation of the phrase purposefully caused a mistrial, what factors should a court examine when addressing that phrase? Is that something that requires the court to review the mindset of the party that requests the mistrial and secures it? Or alternatively performs the conduct? Is it driven by conduct? Oftentimes that's what we look at principally in helping establish intent. I'm not sure that it's clear what factors the court should evaluate.
Well, we indicated some factors in our reply in support of the writ, and one of them would be, for example, if, as I said earlier, if things are going poorly for one side, and it's obvious to the judge that the conduct was done with the intent to cause a mistrial in order to get a second trial. Or there might be other factors. It's similar to a specific intent in the criminal context where the finder of fact would have to take everything into consideration to determine whether there was that specific intent. But what we contend here, and I think the record is really crystal clear, that these defense attorneys did not want a mistrial. They informed the court. Nobody has ever suggested they wanted a mistrial. And that's what the statute required.
Landis apparently maintains that the discussion had surrounding the email and its use on cross-examination created an inference that you folks or your trial attorneys had reservations about the use of the document, even though it had been admitted into evidence, and therefore that illustrated an intent to secure a mistrial.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, although they contended that Ms. Gordon said that she was waiting for them to object, that's not in the record. That's not in any transcript. And even if they did have some doubt as to whether or not the email was admissible, it had already been admitted into evidence by stipulation. Mm-hmm. And what you have here is really an impossible standard. You had a plaintiff who is a lawyer, represented by experienced lawyers. Number one, they disclose the exhibit in their 16.1 disclosures, including the email. Number two, they disclosed it in their pretrial disclosures. Number three, they didn't file a motion in limine to exclude any reference to the email. Number four, they marked the exhibit as a plaintiff's exhibit at trial. And number five, when it was offered into evidence, they stipulated and didn't object to it. So the standard that the plaintiff is asking and that the district judges here are really, they're asking for the defense lawyers to have been clairvoyant and to be mind readers and to have known that the plaintiff and his two lawyers made mistakes at all five of those stages. And we believe that's just an absurd standard, and there's no evidence here that they used or referred to the email with the intent or the purpose of causing a mistrial. It's just the opposite. And what Judge Early's order says, she uses an even the lowest standard possible. She says that it was reasonably foreseeable that the defense attorney said reference to the email might result in a mistrial. Reasonably foreseeable is a negligence standard. It's not the purposely caused standard in NRS 18.070. And like I said earlier, the legislature could have set the bar much lower, but they didn't. They only allow if it's intentional or purposeful conduct. And I see that I'm down to about 5 minutes left. I would just indicate that there's one other potential interpretation of the word purposely, and that's set forth in the plaintiff's own answer to our writ petition. They refer to Black's Law Dictionary for the definition of the term purposely, and they say it's an act that's done intentionally and, quote, is done with awareness of probable consequences. That's their own definition of purposely. Here's what Judge Baer said about awareness of probable consequences. Judge Baer said, rather, I think what I really think that both you, and he's referring to Ms. Gordon, but you and Mr. Vogel just didn't fully realize the impact that this could have. That's a mistake. And then moments later, he said, you were being zealous. You did what you did. I just, again, don't think you appreciated, or Mr. Vogel appreciated, the impact of what was going to happen. So even if you use the plaintiff's own definition of the word purposely, that it's an act done with awareness of probable consequences, they still haven't met the standard because even Judge Baer recognized that it was a mistake. It was a mistake by the plaintiff's attorneys, what they handled, the way they handled the email, and it was a mistake by the defense attorneys not to be mind readers and not to be clairvoyant and know that the plaintiff had somehow overlooked that email. So I'd like to reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Eisenberg. Mr. Jimerson.
Good morning. May it please the court. Jim Jimerson on behalf of the respondent. I also like to note the presence of Martin Little of Howard & Howard, our co-counsel, and the plaintiff, Jason Landis, I believe, is also attending this hearing. Good morning to all. The respectfully, it can be understood why opposing counsel is not familiar with the record below, as he was not trial counsel. He's been, of course, helping the respondents with regard to this petition. But when the question was asked by Justice Hardesty with regard to what is the improper interpretation or standards for NRS 18.070, respectfully, the answer that you see from the appellant, Your Honor, is that you need to interpret purposely as requiring specific or special intent. They treat it like it is a first-degree murder case where you must find as an element of the crime, of the misconduct, specific intent as a condition to making an award of attorney's fees or costs, as Judge Early did in this case in December of 2019. Nothing could be further from the truth. We did a couple of things to point that out. Number one is the plain language of the statute, NRS 18.070 sub 2 says that a court may impose costs and reasonable attorney's fees against a party or an attorney who, in the judgment of the court, purposely caused a mistrial to occur. What is being intentionally, I think, deflected by the appellants is to ignore the fact that it is the court, not a party, who can create a mistrial. It is a requirement of the court to issue an order granting a request for mistrial as a result of prejudicial conduct by a party that occurs. The person or party who creates the statement of facts, the events that result in the court ordering a mistrial, that is what has to be purposely conducted. So that is why you have in Leochi versus Cohen an example, Your Honor, Nevada Supreme Court decision, that a claim of misconduct cannot be defended with an argument that the misconduct was unintentional. I would suggest that the record compellingly demonstrates that it was the defendants or appellants in this matter who were seeking to introduce verboten evidence about racism allegedly against the plaintiff in ignorance of Flanagan, State versus Flanagan, in ignorance of Leochi versus Cohen, in ignorance of the United States Supreme Court case of Dawson, which recited to the parties that this was an issue of race in a medical malpractice case, absent some extraordinary reason, is absolutely impossible to be brought in. It's absolutely prejudicial and is a manifestation of a loss of administration of justice that cannot happen. It is absolutely impermissible under this record. Three judges, Your Honor, have so concluded. Judge Baer, over 70 pages on August 5, 2019, reviewed with this court, has reviewed all of the elements and conduct. So I would answer the Honor's question by suggesting that opposing counsel has attempted to cause this court to interpret 18.070 with an unduly high, impossible standard, somehow get into the mind, the subjective view of a judge, of a lawyer or a party as a condition to finding or awarding fees. No, this is a general intent statute. Purposely has a clear meaning as recited in both Black's Law Dictionary as well as in Nevada Supreme Court decisions. And we cited that in a brief at page 40 with regard to it's the product of conscious design, intent, or plan that it be done and is done with awareness of probable consequences. That's what happened here. We need, you know, every case is distinct. Every case is unusual. And what you have here is you have mistakes made by myself personally and by our plaintiff's counsel to agree to admit a document, the contents of which were not known by the lawyer at the time. However, what is critical in this analysis, and of course is nowhere referenced by opposing counsel, is the plaintiff never sought to introduce this evidence whatsoever. The plaintiff never once sought to have this evidence heard by the jury. It was the defendant who created a plan or a scheme that is, of course, ignored by appellant in his opening statements here, that caused this to occur. They discovered the document in May of 2019. They isolated it as one they were going to use. They also were going to use two other emails from that same exhibit. It was 32 emails of 79 pages in length, one exhibit collectively grouped as Exhibit 56. The offending email was found at page 44 of that exhibit. The plaintiff did not make any reference to this subject matter. The plaintiff did not go anywhere near that in any of their examinations of both the plaintiff who was on the stand for 3 days or of the employer, Mr. Darianini, who was representing the employer, Cognotion, Inc. None of that was broached. The appellants isolated the document, knew they were going to use it, had it as part of the cross-examination of the defendant's employer, or the plaintiff's employer, yellow highlighted it, prepared it for the Elmo. And these are all steps that take time, effort, and energy. They take planning. This court was a lawyer before it became a judge and a justice. Other members of the panel are the same. And as gatekeepers at district court level, the court understands how cross-examination or direct examination works, how you prepare for the same, the documents you gather, the questions you're going to ask. It's all a matter of planning. It's not happenstance, and certainly not with regard to counsel on both behalf of the plaintiff or the defendant in this case, as opposing counsel concedes, all experienced attorneys. So what happens? There is a recognition in August of 2019 that race is a boiling issue in America. There were killings in 2015 in Charleston at a church. There was the Trayvon Martin killing. It occurred before this date. With the political climate of both President Obama and President Trump, race was an issue and has continued to be an issue at the forefront of our paper society. This is known by the appellants, defendants below. This is known and calculated by them. I agree with opposing counsel. I don't think the defendants and appellants were seeking a order of mistrial. I think they were seeking to detonate a nuclear bomb for which the plaintiff could never recover, motivated either because of their desire to wipe out the plaintiff or their worry that they were on the wrong end of a case now on its 10th day. Judge Baer, for what it's worth, observed on his ruling that he felt that the plaintiff was ahead on the merits of this case for what it matters. So the answer to Your Honor's question is you have to look at what occurred. What were the facts? Only the defendant sought to admit this exhibit. Only the defendant planned to do so. Only the defendant highlighted the document. Only the defendant had it ready for the Elmo. Only the defendant sought to have the document admitted. And when the plaintiff's counsel made the error of agreeing to it, then threw it up on the Elmo in an instant. And what was highlighted? Was anything having to do with this case highlighted? Was anything having to do with Mr. Landis being harmed by Dr. Devin Bouchard's professional negligence? No. The highlighted pages, highlighted sentences, of which there were two, was my client's cathartic disclosure to his employer about how grateful he is to have the job, that when he was a younger man, he hustled minorities in pool. That had nothing to do with this case. That has offended Judge Baer. It has offended Judge Weiss. It has offended Judge Early. And it came to the conclusion, you see it in Judge Weiss's remarks, in his order. And he also notes, by the way, Judge, that there is a JAVS video recording of proceedings on August 2 in the afternoon where it was plaintiff's counsel's disclosure that Mr. Jimerson was mad at himself. Your Honor, I'm mad at myself that I allowed this to be stipulated into evidence, but I had no knowledge as to the contents of the document. That was something self-disclosed by myself and by plaintiff's counsel. It was not something created by Judge Baer or the defendants. But that being said, it was the defendant who sought to create the document into evidence and who knew in advance of his explosive nature. And that is what is offensive here. That is what is purposeful here. Is there's no reasonable lawyer, no reasonable judge, no reasonable person applying a reasonable man or woman standard can conclude that the actions of the defendant or the appellant in this petition did anything other than a planned scheme of activity to cause severe irreparable prejudice to the plaintiff. And that's exactly what they did. The court has cited Flanagan versus State, the United States Supreme Court in decision in Dawson, the Texas Employers Association versus Guerrero case, all of which, in Bourne versus Eisman, Nevada Supreme Court case in 1998. It is improper to raise race, unless, particularly as a matter of character evidence, unless it is a specific issue in this case. Of course, it is not present in a medical malpractice case at any time. And it is a special category of evidence that is irrelevant, inadmissible, and is one of the central elements of plain error. You don't hear the word plain error from the appellants in this matter, Judge Hardesty. You don't hear it because it is the death to their position. They refuse to acknowledge that mistakes made by counsel do not trump and cannot trump public policy that precludes misuse of race in a case where it is not an issue and where it has such an incendiary impact.
Mr. Jimerson, what do you make of their argument that you put on that witness to put on the good character of your client.
That is not supported by the record. I reviewed this record very carefully, and I invite you, Justice Silver, to do the same. What occurred was simply this. I asked Mr. Darianani, the employer's representative, was it a difficult thing? Was it hard for you to terminate Mr. Landis? Answer, yes. Please explain. That was the question. And in the answer, which goes on for a page and a half within the record, he says only this about his character. Mr. Landis is both flawed, both good qualities and bad qualities. He can tell you the story of Red Riding Hood and never get to the part about the wolf, suggesting that he talks too much. But he has also a good person. That's all he said. And he also, of course, answered the question that it was very difficult, something he did not want to do but felt forced to do to protect his company, to terminate Mr. Landis. That was the question and the answer. All the other questions, and by the way, there's no objection to that question, and there was no motion to declare the answer non-responsive by the defendant, by the appellant in this matter. It came in. But that was all that was said. And then when you look at the cross-examination by defense counsel, Ms. Gordon, then she opens up the gate.
Mr. Jimerson, if you could, I'd like you to address an issue Mr. Eisenberg mentioned at the beginning of his argument, and I would ask Mr. Eisenberg to address this point as well. In effect, he focuses, and you have focused your attention on the second issue raised in this petition, but neither of you have addressed the first issue, which has to do with whether the order entered by Judge Baer was effective at all, and it appears as though this is premised now on the basis of the outcome of the second trial. I'd like to hear your position on that. Are you in effect conceding that because there's been a second trial with an outcome, apparently a defense verdict, that the first issue is moot? I'm not sure that that's the case, by the way. That is a very significant legal question.
Thank you, Justice Hardesty. I concur. We do not concede that it's moot whatsoever. That's why we emphasize the point. First, let's say that Judge Baer spoke for 70 pages of transcript on August 5 as he granted the motion. You have read the findings of facts and conclusions of law. They are detailed. They are almost verbatim, almost word for word, out of the 70 pages of recitation by Judge Baer as to why he was granted a mistrial and how disappointed he was in the behavior of the defendant through counsel. So no, Your Honor, the court clearly had the ability to issue that order. Procedurally, we had submitted the order to opposing counsel who never responded. One reason didn't respond and say, Mr. Jimerson, would you correct this? Would you add this? Would you subtract this? Didn't hear from them whatsoever. Then came 3 weeks later the motion to disqualify Judge Baer. We submitted the order to Judge Baer thereafter, and he signed it. It was a ministerial act, and he has the authority to confirm that which he had already ordered. But when you look at this matter, you have the benefit, and this is one of the unique things about this case, Justice Hardesty, is you have the benefit of having three judges who have all found this behavior to be improper, who have all found the mistrial to be granted to be proper, to be the only remedy in light of the insidious nature of the defendant's behavior and the information that they provided to the jury improperly, that led to each one of those three judges finding the mistrial to be the appropriate order. I believe I responded to Justice your question, but if there are any other questions, I'm happy to answer them. It's always a pleasure to appear in front of you, and thank you very, very much.
Justice Silver, any additional questions? I don't have any.
No, thank you.
All right.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Mr. Eisenberg?
Thank you, Your Honor. There's a lot to cover here in just a couple minutes, but once again, they're suggesting that this writ petition involves the validity of the mistrial. It does not. This only involves the two issues, the validity of Judge Baer's written order filed after the motion to disqualify was already filed, but it involves the statutory interpretation. What does it mean to be to purposely cause a mistrial? Now, what I heard Mr. Jimerson concede today was that the defense attorneys did not want a mistrial. And if that's true, then they did not purposely cause a mistrial. Mr. Jimerson talks about the fact that the witness brought out character evidence when it was not responsive to Mr. Jimerson's question. Mr. Jimerson's an experienced trial attorney, presumably prepared the witness for testimony. And this witness, by the way, is a sophisticated business person who happens to be a lawyer. And he's the one who talked about Mr. Landis's good character. And Judge Baer held that occurred, opened the door for the defense attorneys to be able to bring in rebuttal character evidence to show that the witness's testimony was not accurate. But the only thing Judge Baer held is that that door wasn't open wide enough for the defense attorneys to refer to the email that had already been admitted into evidence by stipulation.
I have to apologize. I must not be phrasing my question adequately to focus counsel's attention on my concern. When a judge is faced with a motion to disqualify that follows some oral ruling, should they stop or can they proceed to enter a written order? This is a fairly significant issue, I think, present in this case.
Well, the statute and we believe by inference the Code of Judicial Conduct require the judge not to do anything further in the case until the issue of disqualification has been decided.
But this motion for disqualification wasn't handled by Judge Weiss under 1235. It was handled under 2.11, which doesn't have a procedural attachment to it. That's significant. Right. So this court, this panel, would be asked to assess whether or not 2.11 requires a judge in which a motion to disqualify is filed, especially for implied bias, to halt any further action until a ruling on that disqualification motion has occurred? Or is that unnecessary? The federal courts, at least one federal court, Bulger, said, no, that's not necessary.
Well, as I understand it, the federal statute, first this court in the Tobin case, said that if the Nevada statute does not apply and a court is going to rely on the Code of Judicial Conduct, then you look to federal procedures except for the procedure about the judge deciding his or her own disqualification. The federal statute specifically says that a judge shall take no further action on the case. And that's... I don't have it at hand here, but it's part of the federal code.
Is it Rule 455 of the federal the analog to Nevada Judicial Code 211?
It's actually 28 United States Code 144. It says a judge shall proceed no further while the motion is pending. And the Tobin case said, okay, if you're not going to rely on NRS 1.235 and you rely on the Code of Judicial Conduct, then you adopted the federal procedure except for that one thing about the judge deciding it on his or her own. So it's we contend that, I mean, the purpose of the Code of Judicial Conduct is to ensure public confidence in the judiciary. And if you allow a judge to continue with the case and to enter orders after the motion to disqualify has been filed, then it's directly contrary to that public purpose. This order was much more than just a ministerial act of reporting what the judge had said in his oral ruling. It was much more, and we laid that out in detail, and it included findings that went far beyond what he said. And then finally, Justice Hardesty.
I'm sorry, Mr. Eisenberg, you've gone over on the time. I know you were responding to our question. I don't think there's anything further. I think we understand the party's arguments, and the case will stand submitted. Thank you very much for your work today and for cooperating with the court and participating virtually. We appreciate both councils communicating with us this way. And while we'd love to see you personally, I thought it went well. Thank you very much, both.